afternoon, everyone. We're looking at why kids aren't growing up. Bad Therapy by Abigail Schreier. We're at chapter number 6, Trauma Kings. Trauma Kings. What did y'all think about the story of a grandmother?
Wow. That is something. And she went through so much and then achieved so much being a female judge back during that time period.
Your grandmother lived to be 94 years old, is what she said. The story is just incredible. Just that story alone is worth reading the book or listening to the book or getting to that story. We don't even talk like that anymore. We don't even think in those terms. What was your first reaction, Darius, when you were reading or listening to this?
Yeah, if anybody should be deemed, you know, a victim of a traumatic past, it should have been her grandma. Yet those conditions made her who she ended up being.
Yeah. What's your best guess for why there's such a traumatic difference between then and today?
I would say perspective and conditioning. There's this kind of diagram that follows people's reactions to the times. Tough times create hard men. Hard men create good times. Good times create weak men. And the cycle continues. And I think she was a product of that generation that saw the tough times and used that instead of as an opportunity to say, woe is me. This is terrible. They did something to affect change. Whereas currently our trauma, in quotations, is capitalized on, where it's used as a social currency as well as literal currency funding these therapists. So I think the perspective on hardship has changed.
Yeah, because coming in 1927, when her grandmother was born, that's 2 years before the market crash. So when you talk, she as a 2-year-old, she's living in the Great Depression.
Yeah.
So, I think that's absolutely, because, I'm like, okay, well, that's then. So I start, as you asked that question, it's like, what, thinking back, okay, in my generation, that would be what? September 11th, 2001, where there was a period of time that seemed to be very productive because there was a sense of new purpose. That then now look where there's a drift again. So it'd be interesting to see, yes, there's a cycle, but what is that? What's the year, the turnover rate on that?
What's the cycle again?
Hard times create tough men, tough people. Tough men create good times. Good times create weak men. Weak men create hard times.
Any validity in that?
I would say so. I mean, with, painting with a broad brush,
right.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say, anyone, has to make that decision, if they've gone through traumatic times, they determine, am I going to let that push me forward to excel, or am I going to let that hold me back? And that was kind of what she brought out. Some, in the case studies, in many of the case studies that, you can study the same people in a neighborhood or the, even siblings, where, one uses their trauma as a child and that pushes them to excel and do great things, where another one ends up, allowing it to destroy their life and they go into lives of addiction. Mm-hmm. Same exact thing happened to them. Just the way they responded to it was different.
Who gets credit for that?
I forget the author's name. He's like a post-apocalyptic author. That was in one of his novels. Okay. I'll look up.
I've heard it before, but I don't know if I've heard it that specifically.
Yeah. And it's been repeated quite a bit.
Yeah. Similar to that.
Yeah.
Mike, what are your thoughts?
I think we could see that in microcosms within families to where, parents went through a hard time, but they made really good. And so it was a good life for their kids. And then their kids then were softened because they had everything given to them. And then they didn't turn out as good. And so then their life was much more of a struggle. I guess we just have to wait and see if it would turn on the next generation. I haven't been around long enough to see, I guess, families to that extent.
Yeah, because it would.
I mean, you see that a lot with the ultra rich, you know, someone that, you know, in essence, you know, pulled themselves up by their own bootstraps and made millions, and then they pampered their children. And those kids, like you said, I mean, they were just weak. They don't do anything.
Yeah.
But then at some point, normally somewhere in the generations, somebody gets a hold of it and realizes, okay, I need to do, you know, I can't just live on my grandfather, great grandfather's laurels. You know, I'm going to go do something. Yes. Or they run out of money and they have to, you know, try to live up to the family name. Mm-hmm.
What's the point of this chapter six?
So she titled it Trauma Kings. And I think the bulk of what she spends her time on, aside from identifying some of there being trauma and whether or not we're labeling it as trauma, because she does spend some time like, you know, if you tell them it's traumatic, then they're going to believe it's traumatic. But if you don't tell them it's traumatic, they'll never think that. So she spends some time on that concept. But she also spends a decent amount of time on attacking a particular psychologist who says that there is basically the body keeps the score, that there's something internal that if you just bring it up, then, you know, she even addressed the fact that they were doing CT scans? They're doing CT scans on patients where they put them in the machine and then ask the questions, then watch the brain activity to see what's going on. And some of these people, their brains were reacting like they were in the moment experiencing it once again. And so that's kind of the thrust of what she brings up is the.
But she kind of brought up the fallacy of that.
Oh, yeah, she
like
does.
Your body doesn't remember that. And then, like, you know, she even said, you know, you can plant false memories. Mm-hmm. You know, she used herself. I mm-hmm. think it was that. It wasn't her mom that drowned when she was a child, or she used the example of someone
that story was in there.
Yeah. You know, a mom, and then her uncle was like, well, you were there, you saw her and you found her. And she was like, you know, okay, yeah, I did. And then later they're like,
in reality, she had.
Right. And then later it was like, oh no, it wasn't you that found her. It was somebody else. But you know, she convinced herself that she really had.
Yeah.
You know, and I think, you know, her point is that therapists can plant these traumatic memories in children and make them believe them, or through certain key words and phrases and whatever, try to trigger false traumatic moments and memories that really aren't there.
Yeah. I thought,
and that was kind of the, you know, that one psychologist was trying to associate the PTSD that a lot of military men go through with children. She's just like, she said, it's not the same.
Right.
You know, I think she even said, you know, watching a whole unit get, you know, killed by an IED isn't the same as, you know, having an alcoholic father.
Right.
Or being, you know, beat as a child. You know, she's like, that's just two totally separate things, but he's trying to force the two together and make that, you know, lump them in the same category. And she's arguing against that it's yes, in some ways it's traumatic, but not to that level where a child's going to have or should have all of those issues resulting from that it's a hardship. And she definitely says it's a hardship. It's unfortunate. It's sad, but those are things that children normally will recover from and excel from if it's not continued to be brought up to them and reinforced that they've had this trauma in their lives.
Yeah. And even going as far as in one area, she uses the T word to just call it that, because it's we've seen I know the last few years I was in the classroom full time, like there was an increase in the use of the word bully, you know.
Oh yeah.
If someone said something unkind to you, they were a bully, you know. And it's just like, you know, and so we worked diligently, like, let's slow the train down. One brief moment of unkindness does not constitute the label of bully. And I think that's kind of what she addresses with the idea of this trauma.
Where are you at?
Well, there was, I actually didn't have that one up because I went somewhere else to bring it up. But is, you know, thinking about what you're saying, Doc, with
yeah, that, I know what you're talking about. She said, you know, they use the T word.
Yeah, they like, called it the T word.
Yeah. But I don't remember
because I thought it was interesting.
A long chapter.
It was. What did you guys think of the left brain, right brain conversation that she was having as far as the I'm on page 114, first full paragraph. She said, this is back when we're talking about the soldiers who endures things versus, you know, a child who maybe had the alcoholic father. But when something reminds traumatized people of the past, their right brain reacts as if the traumatic event were happening in the present. But because their left brain is not working well, they may not be aware of that they are re-experiencing or reenacting the past. They're just as furious, enraged, ashamed, or frozen. And she got into the idea, she gave credit.
Let's preface that he surmised that. That was his preface.
Right. That was right. when running those.
Yeah, the test.
But then she goes on to address the fact about how some soldiers struggled with PTSD, others did not. And there was a development of the hippocampus that basically she was pointing that development to, in the sense of, hey, if this is developed more, then you're less likely to be affected by PTSD. Do you guys, mm-hmm. I need to find that, because that was the thing, because, you know, especially in a military town, as soon as she started talking PTSD and soldiers, you know, that's our world with our ministry, you know. And I'm thinking about, you know, a great friend who has walked very dark times, and then like he comes out of it, and then it's like, wait, I didn't even know that guy. You know, your wife talks about how she feared for her life, and I'm like, dude, you are the kindest, most gracious man I've ever met. But where does that shift happen? So I thought some of those things were interesting, and it'd be neat to see. What is there some scientific, like true scientific, objectifiable truth, not subjective truth, but objectifiable truth that says, hey, if the human brain is, if the hippocampus is developed to this point, you are less likely to be affected by some of those things. And Pastor, you asked about the trauma thing with page 117. It's about the middle of the page. When she's talking about the trauma salesman, that there's this myth of normal. It's the end of, I'll just read the whole paragraph for our listener, but an event is traumatizing or re-traumatizing only if it renders one diminished, which is to say physically, psychically, or physically more limited than before in a way it persists. Matt writes, trauma creates a disconnect from our bodies. If you find yourself with a diminished capacity to feel or think or trust or assert yourself, if you find that holding your pain and sorrow leads you to need to escape habitually into work or compulsive self-soothing or self-stimulating, if you feel compelled either to aggrandize yourself or to efface yourself for the sake of gaining acceptance, if you feel this struggle or you experience the gratitude for the beauty, the wonder of life. And as she's articulating all these, the point is like that some of the questions and the surveying and the things that are going on is like, basically, if you feel anything, you feel good, trauma, you feel bad, trauma, trying to get to that, because she ends the paragraph with that it might well represent trauma's shadow on your psyche, the presence of an unhealed emotion, no matter the size of the T. And then she says, I bet you can guess what the T stands for.
Yeah, it's almost like going to the doctor today and they ask you all the depression questions, like, you know, have you ever felt sad, like, you know, sad and lonely, like, you know where they're going with it, but you almost have to, I don't know. It's just sad that we've
gotten to that. You weren't going to say lie, right? You weren't going to.
Well, I was going to say you have to really answer carefully.
Oh, okay. Right. Like, have you ever felt sad before? Yes. Has that sadness make you felt sadder? When you were really sad, were you sad?
Well, yeah. Now you're getting into the next chapter.
Yeah. And now that you asked me about the sadness, then I'm sad now.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
So
have you ever thought to harm yourself? Well, when I'm cutting, using my, pocket knife, sometimes I don't know. It's just weird.
Yeah. You better not go on the record saying that.
I know.
Go ahead, Mike.
I thought it was interesting. Basil van der Kalk is the, there at the beginning of the chapter. Right now I'm on 116 at the top, but that he's kind of the center of this pushing trauma and how damaging it is, and that everything is trauma. And so he wrote an article in 94 that he eventually turned into a book in the 2000 teens, somewhere there, that was on the Times bestseller list for a long period of time. Interestingly, she circles back with another known colleague, Harrison Pope from Harvard, and Harvard didn't even realize that he had turned it into a book. He was thinking that back in the 90s, they poo-pooed all of his writings and that it was gone. And when she brought it up to him for the writing of this book to this Harrison Pope, that no, he actually wrote a book about it and it was on the New York Times bestseller list. He was like,
is that the one for 150 weeks?
Yes. Yeah. He goes, I thought the memory wars were over. You know, we won, McNally told me candidly. God, here we go again. So, I mean, he was just so surprised that, he thought that what van der Kalk had been talking about, that everything is trauma, was poo-pooed and done away with. And he was totally caught off guard that for the general public, it's out there and it's a very popular belief, even though it might not be within the academic world.
So is the root of that, Mike, our desire to give ourselves an excuse for why we behave the way we do?
Yes.
Or what she brought up, a desire to try to excuse why something's happened to your children or someone in your family. Like she brought up, if your child is diagnosed with ADHD, then they ask, well, did you take this during your pregnancy? Did this happen during your pregnancy? Mm-hmm. And she said women were saying yes, yes, yes. Then when they'd go back and check the medical records, they were like, well, no, that really didn't happen. You didn't take those medications, but they're, the triggers are, they're trying to excuse or trying to come up with a justification of why their child is like they are.
Like any kind of legitimizing it.
Yes.
As opposed to it merely being a sin problem.
Right. Or just
in a fallen, broken world.
That was a genetic, that's how it was. Mm-hmm. They were born genetically like that. And yeah, because of the world, the sinful world, and or the, I shouldn't say sinful, broken world.
Yeah.
Yeah. That we,
what do you got highlighted over there? You got some tabs, Darius.
I did. Basically the stuff we've talked about so far, it's just to kind of remind me of
arrows in his pages.
Yeah. My arrows, just to kind of track along. Because I was trying to really get a gist of the chapter when I was reading it and looking at how she's tracking this idea of memory implantation or even falsified memories and basing it all on the flawed premise of van der Kalk's research that we talked about with the soldiers having PTSD. But to your point and your question, Pastor, it seems like, it's really it's coming from this intrinsic human desire to look for a cause outside of oneself rather than being confronted with the fact that, okay, I might not actually be a good person. And this, I think, goes all the way back to Adam and Eve in the garden. They were looking to pass the blame, and I don't think that's changed. So how convenient is it then that we can, blame this tea for all my problems? Well, I'm not a lazy husband. I've just been traumatized in my past, so this is the effect of that. Oh, I'm not an abusive father. I was traumatized as a kid. It's this look, seeking to place blame externally and take the heat off of oneself, it looks like.
Another way that she debunks van der Kalk in his study is that he starts with people that are having challenges and issues, and then looks into their past to see, well, did you have a trauma that caused it? Mm-hmm. And that skews the data. She cited another test where Wisdom, I can't find the first name at the moment there, but on 125, that this professor, Kathy Wisdom, did a study to where she looked at two groups of children
that were all in the same community.
Yeah. One that did have trauma and one group that didn't have trauma. And then she had follow-up people decades later interview both groups, not knowing which group they were in. And there was totally inconclusive data that those childhood traumas made any difference, that in the both groups, in the end, it was mute. But yet in Vanderkalk, he started at the wrong place and went backwards.
Well, it was, yeah. And it was almost like he, I'm not saying that he did it deliberately, but trying to prove his point based on skewed data. And she, you know, she even said that often researchers will do that in their, you know, trying to get a certain point across. They'll skew their data just to prove a point or to show what they want it to show.
Yeah. And she'll bring out that out in the next chapter also with surveys.
Pastor, with your 20 years in the Army, where would you say, like, true trauma versus this, well, you want to scapegoat for your behavior. Where would you say that line is within your experience as a soldier? Because you can't deny the fact that watching, you know, one of your dearest friends be blown to smithereens is not a traumatic experience versus the, you know, I was shipped overseas and away from mama for a few months. So what would you say, you know, is there a scale or what would that look like?
Yeah, I have no idea. I think it's so different for each and every person that I don't know. You know, I saw stuff that was bad, you know, and I don't want to talk about it, but you just put it in a box and you move forward. But other people, it's devastating and they can never get over it. I don't know why, other than the fact that I think today there's an incentive to be traumatized because of the money associated with it.
Right.
I mean, I think that the deep pockets that the Veterans Administration has is encouraging this. I mean, you'll hear soldiers talking about keeping track of every visit to sick call as early as the first week they're in the, like they're already leaning forward in anticipation of the paycheck at the end of the road.
Mm-hmm.
So if that's your mindset, then to what degree are you looking to be a victim and traumatized? And therefore, everything has the potential of impacting you. I don't know. I mean, I just don't have any idea what the variances are.
Yeah. But so there would be a spectrum then, that there are guys who are looking for the paycheck. So they're going to claim trauma about anything. And then they're the guys who truly would be traumatized by their experiences.
Yeah. How much of your childhood impacts this? How much is the fact that, you know, my dad didn't let me play the victim.
Right.
I mean, it just was not part of our household. I mean, there was total ownership over and over and over and over again, you know, get up, you know, and I didn't think that I had a harsh, childhood. I just thought I had a good dad that was committed to raising a son to be a man.
See, now I would say, you know, for me, my dad was very, I mean, there were periods of time that he could be very, we would say, abusive.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, obviously I didn't get a buyout of it or anything, but, you know, my takeaway was, you know, I'm not going to do that when I become a dad,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I remember talking to my mom and she was like, well, you know, he was abused as a kid, or, you know, he was smacked around and he was this, and, you know, he just doesn't know any better. You know, that's how he was brought up. So that's how he, you know, that's how he brought you guys up, or is bringing you guys up. And I was just, you know, in my mind, it was, well, it doesn't have to be that way. You know, just because it happened to you doesn't mean you can pass it on and do it to somebody else. It doesn't make it right. But yes, there were, you know, he taught us to work hard. He taught us a lot of character building things. We weren't able to be victims, you know, at school. You know, I didn't know till, you know, it was probably in college, you know, he was like, I couldn't tell you how many, you know, times I went to see a teacher and just never told you, because I didn't want you to know that I was talking to a teacher because I disagreed with what they did. Mm. You know, but today it's, you know, I'm going to tell my, you know, somebody told me that just the other, I had lunch with somebody the other day and they were like, well, you know, and that, you know, the teacher said something in class and they're like, well, I'm going to tell my mom and she's going to come talk to you. Mm. And it's just like, oh, come on, like just stop already. But, you know, I think parents tend to breed that as opposed to the opposite mm-hmm. of, you know, if the teacher said it, you suck it up and do it. And they're the, you know, they're the authority in the classroom. What they say goes. And as long as you're in their classroom, then that's what you're going to have to do. You know, but now he might have gone and spoke to him, but he's not going to tell me that and circumvent their authority.
Yeah. And I think you made a really important point there too, Pastor Steve. It's what we're seeing is like an elimination of one, accountability, but two, the conditions that are needed for resiliency. Like what you talked about with your dad, he was able to compartmentalize and therefore you were able to compartmentalize. It wasn't this, you know, encouragement to ruminate and dwell on this so-called past trauma. You had to figure it out in the moment and move forward. Conversely, today we're seeing this encouragement to dwell on the past. And I mean, things are fuzzy enough in real time. How much more fuzzy a year later, 10, 12 plus years later? So kids are being encouraged to stay in a fuzzy past rather than learning how to be resilient and move forward.
Yeah. So, sorry, I walked in, just got here, but, picking up where y'all are at, you know, there's a lot of controversy over whether or not the body does store. So you look at, and mentally they're saying they're like, there's this mental thing that creates a body storage piece. And what she doesn't address is the draining of the adrenal glands. And the fact is that your pituitary glands get to a point of exhaustion where the hormones begin to reduce in the amount of production because of over exertion. And they see this in a lot of combat veterans, especially. They come back with their adrenals low. And it accounts for lower run times. It accounts for muscle fatigue. It accounts for a lot of this. They'll see it in crash victims. It takes a while, and this is why they have to rest for so long of a period of time and be on light duty and things of this nature for their adrenals to come back. So a person that's exposed to long-term chronic abuse, chronic trauma, chronic this type of state, or even a long endurance athlete who goes through like an endurance athlete, ultra marathoners, this kind of thing, they eventually get to a point where they hit a wall and their body crashes. One of the guys that really wrote about this is Goggins, David Goggins, the guy, You Can't Hurt Me, Navy SEAL. And his life was horrific. Grew up under chronic abuse. Him and his mother barely escaped with their lives from their father, from his father, to his grandparents' home. There, he, you know, went through a life of fear and everything else and decided finally he's going to get into the Navy SEALs, makes it into the SEALs. He's on the other platoon of the team that was Operation Red Wing, which was, you know, the Mark Luttrell lone survivor team. Story, part of that crew. He gets out, starts, he's a guy who went through, you know, he went through the Air Force paratrooper, PJ. He was a Navy SEAL. He went to Delta, didn't make it to Delta in the Army, but he's been to all the operational schools. And when he got out, he started running 100-mile races. He finished first in the 135-mile through Death Valley. They call it the bad 135. You know, it's just you have to run on the white line so your shoe soles don't melt while you're running kind of guy. And eventually his body crashed, and they said, you've just depleted your adrenal glands from all the years of this. So there is an essence where the body does store, but it's not like what they're trying to describe here.
We were talking about how she was refuting the one,
Vanderkurt, like, yeah. Vanderkurt.
Right.
It's not the way he describes it, but there is an essence to it. But you'd have to be a person who's gone through something like Goggins for this to be happening to you. It would have to be like you're in almost your entire life is spent and you're in your 40s now, and you're an endurance athlete for this stuff to be catching up to you the way that they're trying to make out for it to be.
Yeah, for an 8-year old.
Yeah, because that's where she separates, you know, military and PTSD versus childhood life trauma, quote unquote.
Yeah.
And he would be proof of that,
right,
to where he did overcome the childhood stuff.
Yeah. And he doesn't have PTSD. And what's really interesting in it is that he's a mile marker, somebody to look at that of, you were talking about markers of resilience. Of course you can't read his book because it's so profane. Definitely can't listen to it.
Oh yeah.
But he is a case study in resilience. The thing about him is that he demonstrates what resilience truly is. Another piece of that really is remarkable in connection to him is also what Jordan Peterson has just come out with in some studies, is that him and another couple of researchers have gone back and they say, you know what you don't hear about today? Split personalities. When's the last time you've heard about multiple personalities? It's gone. It's been replaced by PTSD, trauma. But you know what you didn't hear about after World War II? Multiple personalities. Because it was shell shock. You know what you didn't hear about when they had this whole memory thing going on? PTSD. Because it was recovered memories.
And you're saying we're just giving it new labels?
No, what he's saying is it cycles. And whatever the psychologists come up with, also all of a sudden everybody explodes with it. Mm-hmm. And the only reason that we're having so much anxiety and depression and chronic trauma is because, well, that's what we've all decided to talk about. And it's in vogue. And if we pick another one, it'll go away and everybody else will have the other thing.
If only we could convince them to talk about resilience.
And he said he went back 400 years and it's been that way.
All right, let's get into chapter 7 a little bit. The title is Hunting, Fishing, Mining, Mental Health Survey, Mischief. All right, what's going on in this chapter?
Well, the first couple of pages, she addresses the fact that there are some ridiculous surveys being asked in middle school and high schools for these.
Well, even at workplace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I wouldn't disagree as far as the workplace, but like the one was super shocking to me about asking the 2021 and 2023 youth risk behavior survey. This is page 140, authored by the CDC, asked middle school children, how old were you when you had sexual intercourse for the first time? And then gives the options of A through G, I've never, and then 8 years old or younger, 9 years old, 10 years old, 11, 12, 13 or older. And then, you know, our author, jumps on, you know, real quick to answer to this, because it's like there's a word for sexual intercourse that is had by children at any of the ages listed above, and it's rape. But our public health officials carry on apparently unconcerned, as if it's utterly natural for adults to ask prepubescent children about their sexual adventures. The obvious implication then is that it's sure to be caught by the kids themselves, is that adults expect kids as young as 8 to have interesting sex lives.
Interestingly enough, you know, she cites that Congress back in 1978 wrote a law about 8 things that you cannot ask young people. But yet so many of these surveys are just bullying right through those 8 things, not paying a bit of attention to it.
Yeah. Cause they have their loophole.
Yeah. And she's trying to really drive home the point that continued exposure, maybe a one-off survey, is not going to have an effect of introducing suicide into a young person's mind. But when you have continual survey after survey, talking about suicide, talking about sex, now you are crossing the line of you're introducing something into their thought processes that they would not have thought of on their own.
Right. Which may be something like suicide, but a couple of the others, she talks about a couple of the games, quote unquote, of things like the fainting game or the blackout game, pass out, knock out, tap out, you know, all these, which are basically games where you and others are trying to either get dizzy and pass out on purpose, because you're trying to get this feeling of the feeling that it causes, which even within our own, like our local community, a church here in town that I have a great friend that's the pastor of, he lost a 13, 14 year old girl in his youth group because she was doing a game like this and ended up killing herself with the shower curtain because she had heard about it. And it was one of these blackout type games and she was unaccompanied and killed herself.
Here in Fayetteville?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And this is just within the last 2 years.
Yeah, but this isn't new.
No, it's not. No. And she, her point is well told, because if you put a list like this in front of 7th and 8th grade kids, they're going to go looking to see, oh, I don't know that one. Let me go look that up.
But we didn't have a list when I was in 7th and 8th grade, and we did this. They didn't give us a survey, and we were doing this game in my junior high. We used to squeeze each other till we passed out.
Oh, yeah. That was done on the campus of my Christian college. Guys would do that in the dorms all the time. No,
in my 7th and 8th grade, we as football players would choke each other till we passed out. It was who's tough enough to take it till you can pass out.
It was
a sign of manhood. Could you actually take it? Could you take the center standing on your chest while you were laying on the ground and lay there and not be a little sissy until you passed out while he stood on your chest?
I guess our football team wasn't quite as tough, because I don't remember going through any of those.
It was a rite of passage. You didn't make the varsity if you didn't go through that process.
That's the difference between Arkansas and Pennsylvania.
I mean, we were doing that kind of things. We were using the whole wrestling move where, you know, you get the guy in the sleeper hold.
All right, but back to the book.
Yeah. What's the point of the chapter?
That Jack has trauma.
No. What I'm telling you is that we're making this like it's a new thing. This is a recycle stuff.
No, I wasn't suggesting that it was a new thing. Just the sense of making someone aware of something that they may not actually become exposed to. You were exposed to that because you're on the football team. But the kid who didn't play any sports, who didn't run in your circles, may never have heard of those things unless someone brought the survey to him, which is kind of the point she's making, is that you're exposing children to certain ideas. And she brings up even like weight loss trends or whatever for the girl who might have a body image. You know, have you tried these things for losing weight? That she may try those now because you're putting them in front of her. And the author's premise is these are completely unnecessary questions to be asking children.
Yeah, and it seems like a really powerful follow-up, putting a practical face to what she was discussing back in chapter 6. Like, she ends the chapter citing Elizabeth Loftus, the memory expert, and talked about how what we're seeing is like it's Skinnerian.
She forgot where she put her keys.
Right. Yeah. Hilarious. Yeah. The memory expert forgot where she put her keys. But she cites or roughly alludes to B.F. Skinner, the psychologist, operant conditioning, this idea of positive reinforcement. So if you've never heard of B.F. Skinner, he had the experiment with the rat where he puts the rat into this little cage. It's got a lever, and every time it touches the lever, food comes out. So it recognizes then that over time, if they do this certain action, something positive happens. And she's using chapter 7 now to discuss like this, in conjunction with these false memories and implantation of memory and how it's subsequently rewarded socially, to capitalize on trauma. We're seeing the effects of it. Kids in, 8-year-old kids who are having intercourse, they're having these surveys pushed on them, and they're ruminating on this fact. It's like, well, I've never had that. So by saying this, you're saying that it's normal for kids my age to be having sex. So what's wrong with me? I need to be having sex. So we're seeing this kind of positively reinforced negative trend.
Okay. So is Skinner's theory right or wrong?
I don't know if you can necessarily categorize it as right or wrong. It's something that's observable. Positive reinforcement of something leads to engaging in that behavior.
Right. So another experiment recently released in the last 2 years with rats almost did the same thing. So on page 141 in the 2021 Florida High School Youth Risk Behavior Survey by the CDC asked a lot of questions about drugs. Mm-hmm. Have you tried this? Have you tried that? Have you tried these other drugs? So what they did was, is they put these rats in a kind of rat village, so to speak. And they put the rats with two bottles of water and drug-laced water. And they went to the drug-laced water all the time and everything else. And that's all they had. But when they put the rat with stimuli that was different. I mean, good stimulation that where it allowed them to actually have connections. So now the rats weren't in the rat village before, where they only had the bottles of water, they were separated. They couldn't get to each other. But when they allowed them to have connection to one another, because of them being able to have connections, the rats only drank from the normal water. They would not drink from the drug water till they died. They would only drink from the normal water because they were able to have rat connection. It gives them the idea of human connection, this idea of social connection. So what they're saying is that our cell phones, our social networking, our devices and everything has created a barrier to our ability to social network, to be connected to one another in such a way that we're susceptible to anything that looks like a sense of belonging. So here comes a survey about drugs, and the drug people will take me in. So I'm more susceptible to go to drug use. The sex people will take me in, so I'm more susceptible to go to the sex abuse. The whatever negative, because the evil people are always going to take you in.
To use you.
Yes. So you'll go to them. And the therapist is going to take you in. So you're going to go to them. So the idea is, what kind of village are we building that isn't a use you village, isn't a evil village, but allows for these connections and tears down the barriers?
Related to that, she finishes up the chapter there on 154, talking about how when young people are constantly being given these surveys, it puts them in an abstract by themselves.
Yeah.
And it removes them from the social fabric, compared to if they're in a group and they're having a discussion about suicide, people receive that differently than when they're continually asked these what ifs in hypotheticals when they're just by themselves.
Right. Because if they're the rat in the cage, drinking the suicide water bottle, they're more likely to do it. But if they're in a group having a discussion about suicide, they're going to be picking up on the social cues and everything else, and they're going to be drawing strengths from the ones that don't idolize it, don't have ideation of it, mm-hmm. and they're going to draw the strength from them because that's where they're going to get the strength of the resilience from. That's where the resilience is going to come from, is from somebody else, Darius. It's going to come from that connection of the human life. And because you would look at me with disappointment, I'm going to come back tomorrow. I'm not going to do it tonight, would be the idea. But when I'm, like you're saying, Mike, if I'm disconnected tonight, I'm going to take that final drink from that suicide water bottle, and I'm going to be that dead rat in that single cage.
All right, chapter 8. Full of empathy and mean as hell.
No, we didn't read that one.
Oh, we did 6 and 7?
Yeah, just 6 and 7. Next week will be 8, 9, 10.
8, 9, 10. Oh, we did 6 and 7 because 6 was so huge.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then we'll have one more week after that. There'll be 11 and 12.
I don't know, but the chapter 8 has got a nice title.
Mm-hmm. Full of empathy and mean as hell.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like a lot of people I know.
Yeah, it's not a Christian book. You know, the listener needs to know that.
We did get our first Christian reference in these chapters,
though. Yeah, she referenced Job.
I had to go back and read it again. Wait, she meant Job, right? Like, oh no, she capitalized that J. Like,
Job's in the Old Testament, so it counts.
And she used the word faith early on in chapter 6, but it was totally not a Christian faith that she was using that in.
Yeah. She's mentioned God a lot, but not in the context that we
did. Y'all ever take any of these mental health surveys when you were in school?
I didn't. Well, I went to Christian school.
Yeah. No, I went to a Christian school. They were more concerned about whether or not you read the right
Mike, Bible. You went to public school.
Yeah.
You're the same age as I am.
Yes. I would say once in a blue moon, I remember taking a survey, but not to the extent that I think public schools are using them now.
I mean, I didn't to the extent they're using them now, but I think I remember taking one in junior high, and I think I remember taking one in high school.
Yeah.
I remember it asked a couple of cursory questions about sex. It asked some questions about drug use. It asked some questions about suicidal ideation and some other things, but not as extensive as the questions I'm reading here.
Yeah, no, I didn't get this level of intensity until I was in for a job interview and had to go to a psychiatrist and do a survey.
I didn't get similar to this. I didn't get this till I went to the VA.
Yeah. So, but yeah,
that's what I was in the beginning. I said, you know, I wasn't familiar with any of that till, you know, they started asking you when you went to the doctor for your annual physical, and they started asking you all the, you know, depression questions and
all that's been since COVID.
Yeah. That's like the last 3 years. Yeah. It's every time your check-in pops up on your phone and it's part of it.
And it's interesting too, looking at that list on 141 into 142, it's strikingly, like scarily similar to the assessments and questions that I was asked on my redeployment survey. So like getting back from being in theater, these are questions that are very pointedly asked, and kind of go back to,
oh, yeah,
to
chapter 6. I remember that.
Oh yeah. And like, you know, you mentioned community, like, you know, we would come back as a unit and like everybody individually goes into the session and it's like, hey man, like, what did you answer? I was like, oh, well, he kept asking me if I was going to kill myself. And by the end of the time with him, I was like, okay, if you don't stop asking me about suicide, I'm going to want to, and like jokingly, but in community, it kind of alleviated that negative effect, but I don't think kids are really getting that when they're being exposed to all this.
You know, we came out of theater from one deployment and they were asking us questions. And I remember we were the only company that had to lock up our weapons and turn them in. And all the other companies were still allowed to walk around in this preliminary destaging one. And they made us all lock up our weapons and they all got to keep theirs. I guess we didn't answer the questions right.
You know, as we're coming to a close, the one interesting thing that we haven't talked about through the two chapters is when you're in group therapy and basically one-upping somebody in that therapy session to where, you know, somebody starts off with, well, my trauma is this. Mm-hmm. Well, then somebody else in that group therapy session feels like, well, I've got to up mine. And well, my trauma is this. And how dangerous that can be for young people.
So two men in this room are still raising children. Darius, your boys are a little bit younger than Brian's. Any takeaways so far from reading this book as a dad?
Go ahead, Darius. I'll let you go first.
Yeah. This has been a poignant reminder that the end goal is not just to have an okay kid. Like I'm raising my sons to be men, ultimately to be men who know and fear the Lord. So I need to be creating the conditions and allowing them the space to be resilient, talking about things with them, allowing that open line of communication, but also not coddling them. I don't want to perpetuate that cycle that I discussed earlier, by pampering them and coddling them to the point they can't do for themselves. I'm not going to be a harsh dictator by any means, Lord willing, but I don't want to create this condition for my sons to become entitled and not be able to function as adults, and then to be able to cite some childhood trauma as the reasoning for that. So raising them according to scripture, lovingly, yet allowing them that space to kind of figure things out for themselves. And practically what that looks like, this morning, Isaiah didn't want to go to school. He's saying that he's feeling sick. I see no overt signs of him being sick. So I said, son, you're going to get up and you're going to go to school. You're not sick enough to the point where you can't go to school. So we're going to go. You have a responsibility and we're going to follow through on that.
Now, did that create any tension between you and Erica?
A little bit.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think that's where men just capitulate. Because they don't want the tension. I mean, they just don't want the tension with their wives. You think I'm wrong, Jack?
No. I think you are absolutely correct today.
I just don't think.
I think mothers capitulate too, though.
Sure.
To the child.
Yep.
Yeah.
I think the children run 95% of the households and they have for the past 30 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that, Darius. I'm like, no, you can't be there already. So first week of school, second week of school, my younger son had the stomach bug. And it transitioned into what I legitimately think is a level of anxiety within him that he is afraid he's going to like get sick again and makes himself sick. Mm. Not throwing up, but he's, you know, having to go to the bathroom too much for a normal day for a 7-year-old boy. And at first I was like, yeah, whatever, you know, your stomach's getting back over this. And then it's continued to the point that now he's tracking how much he goes to the bathroom and, you know, we're talking about it or whatever. But I know because his mother hated speech so much in college that when she had to give a 5-10 minute speech to her speech class, that her anxiety and worry and stress about being in front of people would cause her gut system to just be flipped upside down. That because I have that knowledge in the back of my brain, I'm like, well, your physical structure, like you favor your mother. And so now I'm walking through this where I got a notification from the nurse yesterday and again today and had to go sit with my son for 10, 15 minutes this morning because he is in tears over, I don't want to go back to class. I want to go home. I want to be with mom. I don't feel good. I'm going to be sick. And so it's just like, look, sometimes dad has to go do things when I don't. Of course, I want to be at home with mom and your sisters too. Yeah. But we have responsibilities. And someday God, I told myself, like someday there's going to be a little boy or a little girl whose dad's going to be, his name's going to be Liam, and he's going to have a wife, and they're going to need that Liam to go do things he doesn't want to do because he's their daddy.
Yeah.
And if I let you go home now, you're not going to become that daddy. Mm-hmm. And
you're me.
full of empathy and mean as hell of chapter 8. But it was, you know, and it took a little bit to get him to calm down and kind of, you know, so. But with him, we're going to have to be more rewards based on, okay, let's do a sticker chart. How many days did you go without going to the nurse and complaining about this? Like, can you push through? Because I legitimately think it is just, it's a more natural anxiety thing because he doesn't have that problem on the weekends. Mm-hmm. So I don't think he's got a medical condition. I think it's, I'd rather be at home with mom and sisters right now. It's more fun than being here. Whereas my other child could care less,
he wants school trauma.
Yes. Oh, and you know, not to give him that out, but I did ask him those questions like, okay, well, something going on in school that's bothering you, you know, is there, and there's nothing. So as a parent, being sensitive to the fact that you need to have the conversation with your child, but not give them the out. Because that's what that's where I think the other ditch of this is, you know, you read this book and you're like, okay, don't ask the feelings. Don't ask the questions, like have the conversations. But at the end of the day, you have a responsibility and there's no reason why you can't fulfill your responsibilities, because this is what God has called you to do at this stage of your life.
All right. We'll be back with you next week to continue our look at this book. And we pray that it's helpful to you and you're giving more thought to how you're raising your children and who's surveying them. Who are you allowing to ask them questions? Are you protecting them from outside influences? Those kind of things are what you should be thinking about. Thanks for listening. Have a great afternoon.